Chapter 3. Once, Ai Ming said to me, "Ma Li, I'm sure I've disappeared. Have I? Can you really see me?" She lifted her right hand and then her left, ever so slowly. Unsure if she was teasing or not, I echoed her movements, imagining I was at the mercy of the wind, pushed forward, turned sideways, only by forces unseen. "I'm invisible too, Ai Ming. See?" I pulled her into the bathroom where we stared at our reflections as if they, and thus we, ourselves, were a mirage. It's only now, in hindsight, that I think she saw her own disappearance as a quality to be desired, that perhaps she needed, finally, to live unobserved. It was 1991, mid-March, and Ai Ming had been with us for 3 months. Ma was working all the time now, and had taken an extra job to cover expenses for Ai Ming for the future. I decided to use my Chinese New Year money, my lucky money, to treat Ai Ming to dinner. My plan was to take her to my father's favorite restaurant. The night we set out, the weather was mild, and we held hands as we walked beside the shrubs on 18th Avenue, past sagging houses and unkempt lawns, beneath cherry blossoms that perfumed even the saddest-looking blocks. At Main Street, we turned north. I remember that an old gray cat lay in the middle of the pavement and didn't move as we approached. She only stretched 1 foot further away and swiped her tail from side to side. The restaurant seemed to step out from the shadows wearing a vest of lights. It was a Polish place called Mazurka. It was warm inside, and a quarter full, and there were white napkins and heavy utensils and tea lights in miniature glasses. With Ai Ming, I felt grown up and worldly, a true sophisticate. She, after all, came from Beijing, a city that, in 1991, had 11 million people. Ai Ming had explained to me the law of large numbers, LLN, and the various methods of constructing a mathematical proof, including the proof without words, which used only visual images. I marveled at statements like, "If we know X, we also know Y, because..." Or, "If P, then Q..." In the summer of 1989, while still in Beijing, Ai Ming has sat the National University entrance examinations. Shortly after, she had been offered a place in the newly established computer science department at Tsinghua University, the most prestigious scientific university in China. "I should have gone," she told me. "But how could I?" Her decision not to attend Tsinghua, a principled but reckless choice, astonishes me now. But when I was 11 years old, I told her it all made sense. Over cabbage rolls and pierogies, Ai Ming told me that she was grateful for my mother's generosity, but she felt unworthy. She felt vulnerable in the daytime, afraid to be seen, but she needed to be courageous and start her life again. Ai Ming told me that solitude can reshape your life. "Like a river that gets cut off from the sea," she said. "You think it's moving somewhere, but it's not. You can drown inside yourself. That's how I feel. Do you understand, Ma Li?" I remember the night before Ai Ming came to live with us, when I had submerged my face under the bathwater and imagined what it would be like to stop breathing, to stop time, as Ba had done. I said I understood, how I yearned to understand everything. The candlelight grazed all the objects of the room. The waiter spoke to us kindly, as if we had come from very far away, from a place where words waited for their echo. I feared my childhood would pass before he finished a sentence. And even when I answered him in my impeccable Canadian accent, he continued with the slowness of the ages, until I, too, felt my pulse slow, and time became relative, as the physicist had proved it was. So perhaps Ai Ming and I are still seated there, in a corner of the restaurant, waiting for our meal to come, for a sentence to end, for this intermission to run its course. By then, Ai Ming had decided that she would attempt to enter the United States. The amnesty for Chinese students arriving after the Tiananmen demonstrations had ended, but in March, a school friend of her mother's wrote to say that the U.S. Congress was considering a new immigration bill, similar to the 1986 blanket amnesty that had pardoned 2.8 million illegal aliens and granted them permanent residence. The stipulation, then, had been that the applicant had to have been residing in the United States for at least 4 years. No one knew what the new restrictions might be. The friend, who lived in San Francisco, offered Ai Ming a place to live temporarily. She said that to delay was foolish. My mother had already obtained a forged passport for Ai Ming and other related papers. Neither of us wanted her to leave, but the decision was not ours. My mother's low income meant that we did not qualify to sponsor Ai Ming's immigration to Canada. Ai Ming felt sure that one day, later in our lives, I would visit her in the United States. She would boast that she knew me because, by then, I would be well known. "An actor," she guessed. I shook my head. "A painter?"
"No way."
"A magician."
"Ai Ming,"
I groaned, aghast. She smiled and said, "A writer. Sentences are equations, too."
"Maybe."
"An expert in substituting numbers for numbers?" I had no idea what that was, but I smiled anyway and said, "Sure." Only later did I find out it was the Chinese term for algebraic number theory. She told me I possessed what every great mathematician required, an excellent memory, and a sense of poetry. I felt she saw into me, past every facade and flourish, and that the more she knew me, the more she loved me. I was too young then to know how lasting this kind of love is, how rarely it comes into one's life, how difficult it is to accept oneself, let alone another. I carried this security, Ai Ming's love, the love of an older sister, out of my childhood and into my adult life. Or perhaps it could be that I have taken all our remaining conversations, all the half-finished and barely begun ones, and put each word into this particular night, that I have projected back in time some explanation for the inexplicable, and the reasons that I loved her, and waited eagerly for each and every letter until the day arrived when no more letters came. Did she try to return to Shanghai and to her mother? Did she make a success of herself in the United States? Had there been an accident? Despite my efforts, I still do not know. It could be that I'm misremembering everything. I had only a small understanding of the things that had happened in her country, my father's country, in 1989, at the end of spring and the beginning of summer, the events that had necessitated her leaving. Here, inside my father's favorite restaurant, I asked the question I had been longing to speak aloud, to ask if she had been part of the demonstrations in Tiananmen Square. Ai Ming hesitated for a long time before answering. Finally, she told me about days and nights when more than 1 million people had come to the square. Students had begun a hunger strike that lasted 7 days, and Ai Ming herself had spent nights on the concrete, sleeping beside her best friend, Yi Wen. They sat in the open, with almost nothing to shelter them from the sun or rain. During those 6 weeks of demonstrations, she had felt at home in China. She had understood, for the first time, what it felt like to look at her country through her own eyes and her own history, to come awake alongside millions of others. She didn't want to be her own still river. She wished to be part of the ocean. But she would never go back now, she said. When her father died, she had been dispossessed. She, too, had passed away. Aiming told me that I would always be family to her. I would always be her little sister. Ma Li. Marie. Girl. With my many names, I felt like a tree with crowns of branches. She sang snippets of songs Big Mother had taught her, and we laughed all the way home. When we arrived, I felt that, little by little, our arms disappeared. The shape of our bodies ceased to exist, even our faces, so that inside we were well and truly hidden, erased from the world. But this did not seem a loss. We embraced the possibility of being part of something larger than ourselves. Back in our apartment, Ai Ming had not turned the lights on. She made tea, and we lay in the darkness and stared out the windows, into the courtyard and the neighboring mysterious homes. Ai Ming continued to tell me the story of the Book of Records, which was not, after all, a recapitulation of those 31 notebooks, but about a life much closer to my own, a story that contained my history and would contain my future. When Swirl and Wen the Dreamer married in Bingpai in 1951, the singers and booksellers of Shanghai arrived bristling with musical instruments and hand-copied books. Wen's uncles slapped his back, sucked the ends of their long pipes, and shouted, "Your wife is a treasure. Old West is smiling down on you." They played cards and smoked so heavily, the resulting thick fog washed out into the road and confused passing bicyclists. The old cat, in a three-piece suit, danced with such elegance that even Ba Lute, itchy in his peasant clothes, wept as he played. Afterwards, the old cat proposed a toast to "that infamous explorer, that giant among men." "Da, wait!" Everyone drank, most thinking this must be the scoundrel who had broken her heart. The party seemed to expand beyond its limits, twirling forward like a well-known song with extra verses. Sparrow had written a piece of music, a truncated sonata with main theme and development, and he hummed it to Wen the Dreamer as the sun rose into the fog on the second day. In the echoing hum after he had finished, Wen said, "You are, of course, an acolyte of the illustrious Herr Bach." Sparrow didn't understand four of the words in that sentence, but he nodded just in case. "In that case, I have something for you," Wen said. He presented him with three precious records imported from America. Finally, on the third day, as the afternoon drew to a close, Swirl and Big Mother Knife sang a duet, and in their singing bade farewell to one another, to the narrow beds and the childhood fears they had shared, and the open roads that had marked this passage from one breath of life to the next. "I have fulfilled my duty to our parents," Big Mother told herself. Swirl would live here in the village of Bingpai, in Wen the Dreamer's family home. She clutched her sister one more time before turning away. "Everything passes," Big Mother thought, as she sat in the low bunk of the train returning home. Dry shelves of sunflower seeds cracked like kindling beneath her shoes. Ba Lute had met old friends from headquarters and gone to play cards in their private compartment. Sparrow was reading a discarded copy of Literary and Artistic Issues in the Soviet Union. The landscape passed in waves of green and yellow, as if the country were an endless, unharvested sea. West of Suzhou, the train stopped and goods were hustled out by a long line of porters. Big Mother stared out the window and saw a woman her age standing on the opposite platform, a small child in front of her. The little girl seemed lost in thought. The mother's hands rested protectively on the child's shoulders. Big Mother closed her bad eye and pressed the other to the glass. The woman, on closer inspection, was crying freely. Tears slipped unchecked down her cheeks. Soldiers from the People's Liberation Army moved behind her, circling the mother and child with a sly friendliness. The whistle sounded, and the doors of the train slammed closed. Still the woman didn't move. The train pulled away, and the mother, child, and soldiers vanished from sight. Ba Lut returned, half drunk, his limbs clumsy. He tried to fold himself into the space beside her, only partly succeeding.
"Oh, despite your meanness, you're the one I come back to,"
he mumbled, eyes closed.
"Home from the tiresome world."
Big Mother wanted to insult him, but she restrained herself. Her husband's lips were thin with sadness, and his face had aged. Even his gray stubble looked desolate. Outside the window, the landscape hurried past, as if to erase everything that had come before. A year passed, and then four or five, in which Big Mother Knife rarely saw her sister. Swirl and Wun now had a daughter, Zu Li, who had been born a 10-pound juggernaut before stretching into a lithe and sweet-natured child. "The girl," wrote Swirl, "sings all the time. This child is the mystery at the center of my life." Big Mother wrote back, "They turn into wretches." It was 1956, and Big Mother's family had been in Shanghai for almost a decade. In quick succession, she had given birth to two more fluffy-haired boys with soft triangular eyebrows. Ba Lut had insisted on naming them Da Shan, Big Mountain, and Fei Xiong, Flying Bear. "What next?" Big Mother had shouted at him. "Tasty mutton?" The walls of the alleyway house had begun to press in on her like a jacket grown too tight. This morning, for instance, Da Shan was jabbing all 10 fingers into his younger brother's screaming face. Meanwhile, Sparrow was deaf to everything but the records he had borrowed from the conservatory. Her oldest son was about to graduate with a double major in piano and composition, but, night after night, he sat with his foolish forehead pressed to the gramophone, as if the machine was his mother. He was transcribing Bach's Goldberg Variations into Jianpu, and the bourgeois music fluttered through the house, on and on, until Big Mother heard it even when the rooms were silent. Meanwhile, her hero husband was busy leading another land reform campaign. He was always away, overthrowing a landlord's family, repossessing fields of mung beans, flax, and millet, and maybe the air itself on behalf of the people. And if it wasn't land reform, it was song and dance troupes, political study sessions, party meetings, or private flute lessons for yet another influential cadre. Did he even teach at the conservatory anymore? At home he was petulant and insufferable, and looked at Big Mother and the boys as if at a very dirty window. She ignored him. It wasn't difficult. The insults that should have pricked her heart were as harmless as porridge. Still, those pretty piano notes were mocking all the movements she made. They dripped from the kitchen to the bedroom, to the parlor, seeping like rainwater over the persimmons on the table. The winter coats of her family and the placid softness of Chairman Mao's face in the gray portrait framed on the wall. She thought he looked doughy, not at all like the handsome, intrepid fighter he had once been. Regret crawled through her heart and limbs. Did it crawl through Chairman Mao's? Despite her best efforts, loneliness was encroaching upon Big Mother Knife. Around noon, after the boys had left for school, Ba Lut unexpectedly arrived home. Her husband carried his army bag over his shoulders and grinned as if he'd just won a nasty brawl. His padded coat was the same oyster-shell blue as the winter sky, except for a streak of what looked like blood, and it saddened Big Mother that the outside world, with all its hatreds, both petty and historical, had come inside her home. "Stupid me," she said. "I thought the war ended in 1949. Ba Lut had been gone for 6 weeks, and, at the thought of seeing his family again, had broken into a run as soon as he entered the laneway. His wife's indifference made him feel like a beggar. Big Mother was still in her nightdress, and her curly hair stood up on her head like cotton batting. He couldn't decide whether to scold her or comfort her. He threw down his copy of Jie Feng Daily and a pack of front gate cigarettes.
"The party has launched another bold campaign. Aren't you interested? Why aren't you dressed?"
"Oh, good. A new campaign. As Chairman Mao says, after the enemies with guns have been wiped out, there will still be the enemies without guns."
He ignored her tone.
"Haven't you been reading the papers?"
"They closed our office because the pipes froze," Big Mother said. "Everything flooded. We're a unit of more than 200 people, and the committee has to find a new space for us. So I've been liberated."
"That's no excuse to stay indoors and feel sorry for yourself."
Big Mother eyed her husband. He sighed and tried to soften his tone.
"Isn't there anything to eat?"
He took off his coat and went to the water basin, drinking straight from the dipper. Underneath all the padding, she saw that Ba Lut's clothes seemed far too large, as if he had halved in size. Perhaps he had donated his flesh to the peasants. She got up, smashed around, and finally slapped some food down in front of him. Ba Lut acted as if he hadn't eaten in a week. After polishing off a mountain of rice and a leg of chicken, their entire meat ration for the week, Ba Lut conceded he had missed her. She sniffed,
"Is it so bad out there?"
"The usual."
He found a clean cloth and wiped his mouth, then his whole face, pressing down on his eyes. Ba Lut had always been too round and cocky for his own good. This new thinness gave him a vulnerable, starved look, which confused her. He ran the cloth over the back of his neck.
"Our land reform policy is glorious, but the people are in disarray. Still, it's necessary work we're doing. No one can say otherwise."
Without seeming to realize he was doing it, he started humming, "Weeds cannot be wiped out."
"You and land reform," she said.
"You think your mother gave birth to the idea?"
Ba Lut was so startled that he laughed. He checked himself and said abruptly,
"Go to the devil. How can you joke like that? You're going to get yourself killed."
As he put the cloth down, his hands seemed shaky.
"Big Mother, you've got to learn to hold your tongue."
She looked at the bone on his plate, picked clean.
"You're home for a while, are you?"
"I am."
"Good, because I'm going to Bingpai to see my sister."
"Eh?"
he said, his eyebrows lifted so high she thought they would fly away.
"But what about your husband?"
She picked up the bone and chewed on the end.
"He'll survive."
Ba Lut smiled, but then, thinking over what she said, frowned. He slapped his hand on the table, working himself up into a grand annoyance.
"Big Mother, listen here. Don't you know we're right in the middle of a life-and-death campaign? Please, don't look at me like that. I'm telling you, there's a war going on in the countryside."
"It's always a war with you people."
"There you go again. Now just hold on and think it through."
Once Ba Lut got going, she couldn't stop him.
She stared hungrily at his empty plate.
"Some of these peasants, these desperate people," he continued, "have to be forced to remember every humiliation. Forced! They have to be driven nearly out of their minds with grief before they can find the courage to pick up their knives and drive the landlords out. Of course they're afraid. In the whole history of the world, what peasant revolution has ever made a lasting change?"
He rubbed his bald head again.
"I know what I'm talking about. Don't think I don't. Anyway, it was all calming down, but the 100 Flowers campaign stirred everyone up again, encouraging the masses to criticize the party, and now they've done it."
"My work unit has already issued me a travel permit."
"Your husband forbids it."
"Chairman Mao says women hold up half the sky."
She took his plate, picked up the chicken bone, and flung it towards the scraps bucket. She missed. The bone hit the wall and stuck there.
"Be a model father," she said, "and look after your sons."
"Do you always have to be so stubborn?" he yelled.
Balut slumped forward over the table.
"You weren't so pig-headed when I married you."
He was like that. He exploded and then settled right down again, like a trumpet. For the first time in 2 months, Big Mother felt slightly better.
"It's true," she nodded. "I wasn't."
The journey from Shanghai to the village of Bingpai was 19 hours by train and minibus. By the end of her journey, Big Mother Knife felt like someone had broken both her legs. In Bingpai, she stumbled from the bus into the drizzle and found herself in an empty field. The village, which she remembered as prosperous, looked bedraggled and ugly. When at last she trudged up the mountain path to Wen the Dreamer's family house, she was in a foul mood. At his gate, she thought her eyes were playing tricks on her. Surely the driver was a crook, and the fool had let her off at the wrong village, or even the wrong county. Yet, there was no denying that the flagstones looked familiar. The courtyard was missing its gate. It had plain disappeared. Seeing lamplight, she marched through the inner courtyard and into the south wing. There was junk everywhere, as if the fine house was about to be torn down. Entering, she saw a half-dozen wraiths crawling on the ground. In her fright, she nearly dropped her soul, her father's expression. But then Big Mother Knife realized these were not wraiths, but people. People who were busily removing the tiles and digging up the floors.
"Greetings, sister comrades," she said.
A wraith stopped its digging motion and peered at her. Big Mother pressed on.
"I see you are busy with reconstruction work. Each one of us must build the new China, but can you tell me where I should go to find the family that resides here?"
The woman who was staring at her said,
"Thrown out. Executed like criminals."
"Traveling like criminals," Big Mother said. Her instinct was to laugh. She thought she had mistakenly heard "Xing Lu," executed, rather than "Xing Lu," traveler. Another woman made a gun with her hand, shot at her own head, and broke into a chilling smile.
"Firstly, the man," she said. "Secondly,"
she shot again,
"the woman."
"They buried silver coins under the floor," another said. "That money belongs to the village. They know it does, and we'll uncover it all."
Big Mother reached her hand out, but the wall was too far away.
"Who are you, anyway?"
the woman with the make-believe gun said.
"You look familiar."
"I would like to know who gave you permission to be here,"
Big Mother said. To her fury, she could detect a trembling in her voice.
"Permission?"
the woman hooted.
"Permission,"
the others echoed. They smiled at her as if she was the wraith. Big Mother turned and walked outside. She went slowly through the inner courtyard, all the way to the front of the house. Here, she lost momentum and sat down on a low brick wall 100 yards from the entrance. Nobody had followed her, and the kerosene lamp continued to flicker from inside. Now she heard the thwack of their shovels. That bus driver was the grandson of a turtle. He'd certainly dropped her at the wrong place. Balut's warnings were getting under her skin. She pulled on her hair and tried to wake herself. She pressed her hands violently to her face, but no matter what she did, her eyes refused to open, and the dream would not end. She stared all around and saw the absurdity of her traveling bag, the muddy ground, the gray house, and tiny night stars coming out. She would have to go back into the house and straighten things out. Yes, she would go back inside. It was a strange, windy night, and she could hear a shrill cry echoing over the hillside. What ghosts were visiting this place? She could hear shouts now, coming nearer, and the ringing of a gong. A funeral, she thought numbly. But still, Big Mother did not stand up or withdraw. A crowd was coming along the road, swaying and heaving in a procession. Big Mother pushed herself onto her frozen feet. She had no idea how long she'd been sitting here, but the women with the shovels had gone home. In the fog, and in their excitement, they had not even seen her as they passed. As the parade approached, Big Mother could hear their voices more distinctly. Although there was indeed a gong, bells, and the occasional burst of singing, it was not a funeral. Certain words were repeated. Stand up, have courage, devil. But the shouting was oddly disjointed, as if opposing leaders were battling for control of the slogans. At the head of the procession, Wun the Dreamer walked with his body crookedly bent. A woman walked behind him. Swirl's hair fell loose and wild. She was completely tipped forward, as if she carried a piece of furniture on her back, but there was none. The distance between them halved, and then halved again. Frenzied faces closed in on Big Mother, crying and groaning. She could not make out all the words, but she heard, "Honor the chairman, kill the demons, long live our glorious land reform." "I have crossed into death itself," Big Mother thought. Now she saw that her sister's arms were roped together behind her, in a position that forced her two elbows up into the air. Everyone seemed fueled by exhaustion, as if they had recently been shaken from sleep. The cavalcade stretched along the road, but they were so absorbed by their own noise that they too did not notice Big Mother. The very last person, a small boy struggling to keep up, glanced in her direction, but his eyes did not fix on her. He hurried along. Big Mother stood up, and, leaving a wide gap, followed them. The procession continued for at least another hour. Finally, just before the tree line, the shouting faded, and the people drained away like rivulets of water. By the time Big Mother reached the end point, her sister and Wun had been untied and were standing incongruously by themselves. They were cautiously testing their backs, slowly stretching out their arms. They were carrying their own ropes, as if the ropes were only props.
"Is it really you, my sister?"
Big Mother said. Swirl turned, peering into the darkness.
"Little Swirl,"
Big Mother said again, afraid to touch the woman.
"Is that you?"
Big Mother did not hear the entire story that night, or in the nights that immediately followed. All her sister would say was that these parades, struggle sessions, she called them, had been going on for the past 3 months.
"Most of the time, it's harmless," Swirl said. "They take us to the schoolyard and announce us as landlords. We have to kneel,
but all they want is a thorough self-criticism. Occasionally, like tonight, we're paraded through the village. Big Mother could not contain her fury.
And the rest of the time?
Swirl glanced at Julie, who was folded into her father's lap, and said nothing. Everyone spoke in whispers, as if afraid to wake the gods of destiny, or even Chairman Mao himself. The hut, with its mud walls and straw roof, was meant for animals. That much was abundantly clear. Big Mother wondered where the evicted pigs and cows had gone.
"We're not suffering," her sister said.
It was inevitable. When the dreamer told her, his voice barely louder than the steam from his tea. Justice had to be done, eventually.
In this way, 2 days and 2 nights passed in a silence that cut deeply into Big Mother. She did not need a lengthy explanation. It was clear what had taken place. But in Shanghai, she had not witnessed the land reform campaign. In the cities, people from all corners of life and with every political affiliation had been reassigned to new quarters. People who had lost their homes were given new ones. It had been part of the war recovery. On the third night, Big Mother lay on the kang beside her sister and the child, Zhu Li, who was already 5 years old. The child snored vigorously. The kang, heated from below by a charcoal stove, looked like a relic from somebody's tomb. To make space, Wen's elderly mother had gone to stay with a relation. Despite the relative warmth of the heated bed, her sister was shivering.
"Tell me something," Swirl said suddenly. "Just a few words to distract me from this place."
Big Mother swallowed several times to alleviate the dryness in her throat. Outside, Wen was smoking. The thin walls might as well be cloth. She told her sister about Sparrow and his brothers, about the Jianpu music that ran from page to page. Sparrow never stopped composing. He didn't breathe, she thought. He only emitted music.
"My boys are energetic, and have more hidden thoughts than a cartload of books. A mother never knows her children as well as she imagines."
"How true. How true," her sister breathed.
Big Mother said she'd been back to an old tea house where they used to sing, the Purple Mountain Tea House.
"They've changed the name," she said.
"It's now the Red Mountain People's Refreshment House." Swirl giggled. "The rooms are closed, and all they serve is tea and melon seeds. But still, the usual crowd comes to chatter, drink a little, or fill their canisters. There are even singers who perform the new repertoire, the East is Red, Song of the Gorillas, and all that. It's stirring. Who can argue? Even I want to overthrow something when I hear it. But revolutionary music hurts the ears after a while. There's no nostalgia in it. No place for people to share their sorrows. Of course," Big Mother continued hurriedly, "in the new China, such sorrows as we knew are long gone." She went on to describe a few of the patrons, including the ones who still came with their orioles and thrushes, and the storytellers and balladeers who now told the epic of Chairman Mao's long march in 50 dogged episodes.
"Do you remember that book I told you about?" Swirl asked. "The 31 notebooks? The Book of Records?"
Her voice barely reached Big Mother, even though they were curled together on the narrow kang.
"You burned it, I hope. Anything that inspires such devotion is surely banned."
"Burn the Book of Records?"
her sister asked, a flash in her voice, indignation.
"How could I?"
"To save yourself," Big Mother said.
"To save myself? I couldn't.
The book was still in its hiding place inside the family home. Tucked into the pages were all the letters Wen the Dreamer had written to Swirl. When those hungry spirits found no silver coins, they would open the walls. Nothing hidden would remain unseen. Swirl described the coded names, how the ideograms used for Tha Wei and May 4th changed, and seemed to refer to compass points on a map. Big Mother felt a terrible chill. The love letters would be bad enough, but what was in that book anyway? What if it turned out to be written by a nationalist traitor? They would all be screwed to the 18th generation.
"I need to go back to the house," Swirl said. "I have to get those notebooks back."
"Don't be a fool." The words were spoken harshly, but Swirl didn't seem to hear.
"Wen's grandfather was a copyist, too, did you know? There are books hidden in the ground that have been preserved for centuries. All the books that Old West brought from America..."
She pulled the cover up to her chin so that only her eyes and the bridge of her nose were visible.
"Everything on this earth has its lifespan, and then it must be natural. We have to make it disappear. As if the new didn't come from the old, as if the old didn't grow from the new."
Big Mother hesitated, and then she asked softly, "But what is this upheaval?
Haven't you seen it? I thought the land reform campaign had reached everywhere. During the war, I'll never forget the cruelties we saw. I understand why nothing can stay the same."
"Of course, but..."
"Once everything is broken, they can build society once more."
How many times had her sister spoken these words?
"They?"
Big Mother said. "The revolutionary committees? The Communist Party?"
"They say it's the wheel of history. I'm not afraid. You know how it is. One hand can't stop the flood from destroying the bank. Only... I worry about Julie. She's been born into the wrong class. She's the daughter of Wen the Dreamer, the daughter of a landlord. Nothing I do can change that. What if I can't protect her?"
"Come with me to Shanghai. My no-good husband can arrange it."
"It's the wheel of history," Swirl said.
There were no tears in her voice, just the cut glass of pragmatism.
"The party says only the guilty try to escape punishment. If we run away, not even Ba Lut will be able to intervene. We can't risk it. I have to protect Julie. But how?"
Much later, in the years after Swirl had been released from the desert labor camps, when Julie had already grown into a young woman, Big Mother pieced the story together. The party men had arrived in Bingpai on the day Wen and his uncles were dragging ice off the mountain lake. It was arduous work, but worthwhile because, once covered in straw, the ice, ever useful, would keep for many months. The uncles used to have laborers but now preferred to do this kind of work themselves. The previous year, when land redistribution had reached Bingpai, the brothers had known better than to argue. There were far worse fates than having to give up a few acres of land. In the neighboring county, a dozen people had been struggled against, a sort of large meeting where accusations were shouted, where the accused were beaten and sometimes tortured and executed. But the dead had been mostly rich men infamous for their savagery. Last year, when delegates from the Bingpai Peasants Association arrived at their gate, the brothers had not resisted and had relinquished the title deeds for all 17 acres of the family holdings, which would be redivided among the village. True, Erke's wife had left him, but he still had the two grown children. And Jizi had talked of killing himself, but no one took him seriously. Meanwhile, life continued. Until land reform was finalized, the fields still had to be tilled and orchards tended. In fact, the harvest of sweet apples that year was the most bountiful in the brothers' memory. As the cart complained its way through the gate, Wun and his uncles were surprised to see two strangers, as well as the village head and the chairman of the Peasants' Association, standing outside. Thaka stepped out from behind the block of ice. He greeted the visitors and invited them inside to share a meal. The village head declined. It was all rather uncomfortable, and Thaka, who had always been impatient, said, "Well, if there's nothing urgent, we'll get back to work. The ice can't wait." One of the strangers who had yet to introduce himself intervened. There was a meeting underway at the village school, he informed them, and the brothers were late. The village head stepped forward. "These two teachers," he said, indicating the strangers, "have come all the way from the county party committee. Of course, as your family is so prominent in Bingpai, how could we start the meeting without you?" In the courtyard, the silence seemed to echo off the bricks and ice. Where was everyone, anyway? Neither Thaka nor his brothers had eaten in almost 6 hours. Still, he led his siblings and Wun through the gate and fell in line, behind the strangers and the village head. At the primary school, Swirl had been bundled off to the side with her daughter, where they knelt with 20-odd others on the cold ground. Among them were the wives of Wun's uncles, who had been brought under guard and were now at center stage. The crowd was already in the hundreds, yet more people kept arriving to take part in the meeting. Thaka's wife was repeatedly slapped and kicked until she cried out for mercy. The fierce, no-nonsense woman, already in her mid-50s, was hysterical. She was pawing at the ground as if trying to find a coin in the ice. Zhu Li had long stopped crying. She clutched her mother, completely silent. Swirl didn't dare try to comfort her. "When I get home," she told herself, "I will warm a little water, wet a cloth, and wipe her frozen tears away. It's nothing. Nothing that a little warm water can't clean away." Now the men came, the four brothers and her Wun. They were surrounded and quickly trussed up. Swirl could hear Thaka shouting. Her daughter was weakly calling out, "Ba!" Swirl cupped her body around Zhu Li, thinking that the child must not see. Nothing must happen. But hands came and pulled at Zhu Li. Voices shouted at the child to open her eyes. She had to learn. Swirl stumbled to her feet and tried to get her daughter back, but they moved decisively and brutally. When she looked up from the ground, she saw that Zhu Li had been lifted onto a man's thin shoulders. The girl sat, unmoving, staring ahead of her. The arrival of Wen the Dreamer and his uncles had brought renewed life to the freezing crowd. New accusations came to the fore. One spoke of the famine and how he'd sold his land to Thaka for nothing. "Robbery!" someone shouted. "You used your good fortune to trample your neighbors into the mud. How else could you acquire over 17 acres in so short a time?" The brother of Erka's wife accused Erka of mistreating her, beating her, and even depriving her of food. Erka denied it. He tried to put up a fight, but others came to knock him down. It was chaos. The strangers had dispersed through the crowd, asking people, "Who beat you? Who humiliated your fathers and raped your daughters? Was it them?" "It was, it was. Who made their fortunes during the war? These landowners think they can spit out a square of land. They think you should get down on your knees and bless them. We must free ourselves." There was revenge in their voices, but also grief and weeping. "Comrades, have the courage to stand together once and for all. A life for a life! Who humiliated you? Tell us, this is not your shame. Why should you carry it?" A woman had rushed into the circle. She pointed at a man in a dark blue gown.
"This man raped me when I was 6 years old," she said. "He covered my face with my mother's clothes, and he..."
She was cradling her stomach and began to sob.
"That was only the beginning. He saw that my father was dead, and I had no one to stand up for me. This monster, this animal, every pain I suffered gave him pleasure."
Someone pushed a shovel into her hands. At first, her blows were weak, as if only grief, not rage, motivated her. But the chanting of the crowd drove her on, and the shovel took on a new, determined rhythm. She continued to land the shovel, even after it made no difference.
20 years of war, and for what? To be thrown back into the gutters of society again? I worked myself to death to harvest 5 ton of grain. Meanwhile, you took 4 ton in rent,
a man said to Daka.
We ate the husks of rice, the husks of wheat, the husks of millet. My children have been hungry from the day they were born. But what are your tenants to you? Nothing but fertilizer.
I gave you fair terms, Daka began, but he was immediately drowned out.
Fair?
The man laughed bitterly.
Pay your debts! Everyone must pay their debts!
If you don't settle with them now, one of the strangers said calmly, these landowners will wait until we're gone, and then they'll wipe you out one by one. You cannot make half a revolution.
Scorn and contempt were heaped on the landlords. The agitation increased. Another family was brought in, and there were more crimes and more denunciations. Together their stories made a claim that no one could deny.
"Are these your countrymen?"
a man said, turning on Wun.
"Isn't this your crime?"
"My crime?" Wun said. The man slapped him.
"Is this your crime?" "I admit it. I accept," he cried.
Wun's nose began to bleed. The man slapped him repeatedly, as if he were disciplining a child. The crowd was laughing, and the laughter had a sharp, bleeding sound. 2 men on the stage were kicked until they no longer moved. Swirl thought she must be hallucinating when the guns were drawn, and Daka and his wife were executed. Torches were lit, and others demanded yet more killing. She saw Wun dragged forward. Her husband begged for mercy. The gun moved away from him, came back, moved away, came back. Her daughter was crying, struggling to free herself from the stranger's rigid arms.
"Ba!"
she screamed.
"Ba!"
Uka was shot in the chest, and then in the face. 3 more men were shot. One would not die and had to be beaten. Swirl felt herself losing consciousness. A deep silence seemed to come at her from every side.
"It's over,"
someone said. She lifted her face and searched the darkness. A woman was hovering over her. It was the wife of the deputy village head, a girl who sometimes came to sit with Swirl in the village school and share a few stories of the city, learn a few songs.
"Go home," the girl whispered. "Tomorrow your house will be taken over by the Peasants' Association. But there are some empty shelters up on the hillside. They'll bring you there. They won't leave you without a roof over your head. They are better than the landlords of the past."
The girl's voice faded, and her form merged into the shadows. Julie was pulling at Swirl's arms now. The child was filthy. When she finally looked up, she saw Wun crouched over the bodies of his 2 uncles, trying unsuccessfully to lift Daka's body into his twisted arms. But all this would not be told to Big Mother Knife until much later. Swirl would not speak, and neither would Wun. At the time, Big Mother did not fully comprehend that struggle sessions
and denunciation meetings still continued. No one else had been executed. Instead, Swirl saw that those who had lifted shovels, who had landed blows or pulled the triggers of the pistols, appeared ill at ease. When they met Wun on the village roads, they stared at him, afraid, as if it was Wun who had killed a man. And if he had not done it with his own two hands, then surely, without him, no violence would have been necessary. At this altitude, the fog was unrelenting. A person could hardly see his own shadow anymore. On the fourth night of her stay, Big Mother lay awake. This entire mud hut, she thought, was smaller than the pantry in Wun the Dreamer's former house. The straw roof, of poor quality, needed to be replaced. It sounded like an ancestor shivering in the wind. She closed her eyes, and a fragment of the famous poem that she had recited at Swirl's wedding came back to her. The marriage of a girl away from her parents is the launching of a little boat on a great river. You were very young when your mother died, which made me the more tender of you. Your elder sister has looked out for you, and now you are both crying and cannot part. Yet it is right that you should go on. The words came from an earlier version of this country, another dream. On the Kang, little Zhu Li dug her heels into Big Mother's back, as if to say, "There isn't enough heat to go around. Keep me warm, old lady, or go your own way." How could such a puny creature take up so much space? Fed up, Big Mother climbed out of bed. The little devil grunted in satisfaction, expanding into the warmth she had left behind. Big Mother found her shoes. She shook them out ferociously. When she was satisfied no prickly creatures had nestled there, she slipped them on. Over top a second sweater, she buttoned her padded coat, pulled down her woolen hat, and went out. The winter air was not so terrible as she had feared. Big Mother pointed her good eye right, then left, taking stock of her position. The moon was muffled by clouds, and so she trusted the compass inside her own head, walking downhill until the trees fell away, and she was surrounded by snow-draped land. A fallen branch sat on the crisp whiteness. She picked it up. "But why am I awake?" she asked herself. "And on whom will I use this weapon?" Her heart, which earlier had been thumping, quieted. When she reached the elegant house, Big Mother did not hesitate. She lifted her stick, strode confidently through the gateless entrance, and climbed the first staircase. Bit by bit, her good eye adjusted to the pall. Here and there she could make out clumps of rubble, but not a whiff of furniture. This morning, she had asked Swirl innocuously if the item she wished to retrieve was difficult to reach.
"Yes and no," Swirl had said. "Do you remember the steps in the east wing that go up to the alcove?"
Instead of ascending all the way, her sister told her, the stairs served as a ladder to reach a high shelf, a very long, narrow ledge.
"On the far side, there's a little opening below the roof. It's a headache to get to it. A person could slip and break their neck. The Peasants' Association will surely look in easier places first."
Big Mother continued through the rooms. Now she found herself at the foot of the alcove steps. Putting aside her walking stick, she paused to offer a poem to the god of literature, because, after all, these mysterious notebooks belonged to his domain. She recited, "When the mind is exalted, the body is lightened, and feels as if it could float in the wind. This city is famed as a center of letters, and all you writers coming here prove that the name of a great land is made by better things than wealth." She ascended. The ledge, when she reached it, was indeed narrow, barely half a foot across, and stretching far along the wall.
The wraiths, however, had done her a favor, because the shelf, stripped clean, was clear of obstacles. Unwieldy as a pigeon, cursing the thick coat she wore, she stood